Hi everyone, I'm Dr. Bill Parker, the Chief Operating Officer of the East West Institute in New York City. Welcome back to another episode of the EWI Podcast, a platform where we explore some of today's key global issues with leading thinkers and influencers. Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming Admiral James Stavridis. Admiral, welcome to the EWI Podcast.
Great to be on with you, Bill.
Admiral Stavridis spent over 30 years in the United States Navy, rising to the rank of four-star admiral. Among his many commands were 4 years as the 16th Supreme Allied Commander of Europe at NATO, where he oversaw operations in Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, the Balkans, and piracy off the coast of Africa. He also commanded U.S. Southern Command, charged with military operations through Latin America for nearly 3 years. He was the longest-serving combatant commander in recent history. Most recently, he joined the Carlyle Group as an operating executive after 5 years as the Dean of the Fletcher School of Law Diplomacy at Tufts University. Admiral Stavridis provides geopolitical context for potential global investments and works with officers of the firm on international issues. Today, I'd like to leverage Admiral Stavridis' significant, deep geostrategic experience and expertise to discuss a few issues on the minds of analysts and key decision makers worldwide, specifically the present and future role of NATO, issues pertaining to Turkey, and the impact of economic policy on national security. So let's jump into the first question. Admiral, to start, some listeners may not necessarily be aware of the fact that Russia and China conducted military exercises earlier this month. This is Russia's biggest war games in nearly 40 years, involving almost 300,000 troops, over 1,000 military aircraft, and two Russian naval fleets. What is perhaps more exceptional is that it was attended by 3,200 troops with 30 fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters and a great deal of armor from China. So, Admiral, what is the significance of these two countries taking such an initiative, and what does this signal to the U.S. and NATO allies?
Clearly, Bill, the Chinese and the Russians are looking for opportunities to work together because they both have visions for their nations that collide with the presence of the United States around the world. China is looking for support in the South China Sea, where they are busily building artificial islands and creating a case in their mind to eventually completely take territorial control of those, of that vast body of water. At the same time, Russia is seeking to dominate nations around its periphery, its near abroad, as it's often called, most notably evidenced by the invasion of Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea. Both of those actions, China's in the South China Sea, Russia's in Ukraine, are outside the bounds of international law, clearly condemned by the vast majority of the international community. And therefore, Russia and China take common ground together in working together because it thwarts the international community and pushes back on positions taken by the United States. So I think there's a kind of a natural confluence of interest between those two at the moment. Now, the real question for us, Bill, is long-term. Is this an alliance, a partnership, a strong friendship, a relationship with benefits? What is this? And I would argue that over the long throw of the 21st century, it's not in the interests of China or particularly in the interest of Russia to align themselves with the other. And I'll put this in very simple terms. Because China needs hydrocarbons and because they need more space, they tend to look at Eastern Russia the way my dog looks at a ribeye steak. It looks really tempting. And I would say Russia ought to be very careful about the degree to which they become involved with China, because long-term, China's geostrategic interests are much grander and much more realizable than those of Russia.
That's fascinating. So, Admiral, does this put NATO and U.S. forces and their future capabilities on any sort of notice?
It does, and it ought to. A good place to start, if you want to contemplate this, is a book I'm sure you've read by our mutual friend Peter Singer. It's called Ghost Fleet. And it postulates an alliance between Russia and China and an attack, a surprise attack, in fact, on the United States. Now, that's fiction. It's a novel, but it lays out a direction that's conceivable. The degree to which the United States wants to maintain its security in the 21st century will depend, in my view, on our ability to maintain this network of allies, partners, and friends around the world. NATO at the top of the list because it has the most military capability. The second largest defense budget in the world, after that of the United States, is the defense budget collectively of Europe, greater than China's, much greater than Russia's. And similarly, in the Pacific, we have marvelous allies in Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, on and on. But that NATO pool of partners, Bill, shares our values, is geostrategically located in prime real estate on the western edge of the Eurasian continent, has all the military capability and technology, and has stood and fought with us in Afghanistan, in Libya, in the Balkans, on and on. So I think we are on notice as we look at the rise of other competing national powers, but the United States would be well served to tend its garden in NATO over the years to come.
So, Admiral, you just mentioned prime real estate. So there's this country where East truly meets West, Turkey, and they've made the headlines for various reasons lately, including a perceived shift in regional relations. As a key member of NATO, what are your thoughts on Turkey's growing relationship with Russia? Or is there a growing relationship?
There certainly is a growing relationship with Russia, but let's back up and sort of do the value proposition of Turkey, which is very, very high, in my view, both for Europe and for the United States. There's a country with the 13th, maybe the 14th largest economy in the world, a population of around 90 million that's growing. Their demographics are very strong. As you mentioned, they're in one of the most important geographical positions in the world. They border 8 different countries. At times, they are described, I think inaccurately, as a bridge between East and West. They're a power center unto themselves. By mid-century, their population will surpass that of Russia, if not sooner. Their economy will continue to grow, despite the fact that it's been pushed down a bit by the fall in the price of the lira at the moment. But over time, Turkey will be a very important player in the global scene. Point two, they have been loyal members of NATO. And when I was Supreme Allied Commander for 4 years, everywhere I went on alliance operations, Afghanistan, the Balkans, Libya, counter-piracy, counter-cyber, everywhere you saw Turkish troops. They controlled the critical regional capital center of Kabul in Afghanistan. They continue to be involved in all these missions. They responded very well to every request we made for troops. And by the way, and you know this, Bill, they have the second largest army in NATO after the United States. Very capable. So when I put those two things together, the vibrancy of the nation and its people and its participation strongly in NATO, I feel as though we need to pull Turkey toward us, toward the transatlantic alliance, toward the United States, toward Europe. At the moment, as we all know, it's very complicated, and now we get to the point of Turkey's rising relationship with Russia. This has really evolved from the debacle in Syria, the complete meltdown on the borders of Turkey. It's a long 600-kilometer border they have with a nation that is dissolving right in front of them in the midst of a horrible civil war. The Turks are not pleased with the way the United States has supported the Kurds, who they view as terrorists and are very concerned about separatist movements in Turkey. So there's been a division, a slipping away from the United States over the Kurdish issues and from Europe over the continuing opposition of many European nations to membership in the EU for Turkey. So when Turkey looks around the region, where do they see potential partnerships? Unfortunately, they see them in Vladimir Putin and even worse with Iran. Not partnerships, not quite yet, but there is certainly a lot of chatter on the net between Ankara, Tehran, in Moscow. That is very much not in the interests of the United States or the NATO alliance. I don't want to overstate that. I think Turkey, in the end, will remain oriented toward the transatlantic. But for the moment, we need to do all we can to pull them back our way.
So, Admiral, you feel the prospect exists but not likely right now, if I'm hearing you right, for Turkey leaving NATO alliance. Is that true?
That is true. There are certainly going to be some centrifugal forces that pull at Turkey pulling out of NATO. It is a conversation that we ought to have, but we ought to have that conversation in the context of this would be disastrous for NATO. We've never had a nation quit the alliance. Turkey is one of only two Muslim nations in the alliance, the other being Albania. Losing that kind of diversity from the alliance, that kind of geopolitical position, that kind of military capability, that economic throwaway, it would be a serious blow to the alliance. What should we do? Our senior leaders ought to visit Turkey early, frequently. We ought to have dialogue at every level. We ought to use the military-to-military contacts that we have. For example, the new Minister of Defense, Hulusi Akar, is a former chief of defense, well known to many of us. We need to use those personal relationships wherever we can. There are things we have to criticize about modern Turkey, some of the actions President Erdogan has chosen to take concerning the media, concerning the jurists in the nation. But on the other hand, we need to criticize in private. We need to collaborate in public. We have to pull back at Turkey to get them back in the fold.
So if we shift to economics in the United States now for a moment, how do you see the current economic climate in the U.S. impacting national security? And specifically, President Trump has made it clear that economic security is national security in a speech he made last year. So what is the administration looking for here that you can see, and what are their concerns, and what should other nations understand from that U.S. position?
I think there, as usual, is good and bad in the theory of using economic tools for national security. Let's face it, all nations do that. All nations have a theory of the case that says we will use all the elements of national power to try and create winning outcomes for our nation. Understandable. What I worry about is a tendency in this administration to overweight, if you will, economic warfare, and that's really what tariff barriers are all about. They're kind of economic skirmishes, but skirmishes can lead to real wars. And I am particularly concerned here, obviously, in the context of China. What we want to avoid, as our friend Graham Allison has written so eloquently about in his book, about how the United States and China can avoid war. It's called Destined for War. And by the way, there's no question mark on the cover of the book. We need to avoid using economic levers in a way that provoke and move us toward military confrontation. So we had to worry about that aspect of things. On the positive side, I think that the strength, in the end, the military strength of the United States, and you know this better than anyone, Bill, is generated by our economic capability. So when the economy does well, we have the money to purchase the advanced systems that keep ourselves ahead in everything from artificial intelligence to quantum computing to space to cybersecurity to maritime platforms, fifth, sixth generation fighters. We're not going to get that unless we have a strong and vibrant economy. So these things fit together. There are positive benefits that enhance our security. We simply need to be careful we don't overweight the confrontation, particularly in the economic zone, because as we saw 100 years ago in the run-up to World War II, this is how Japan and the United States ended up eventually in a war, which of course pulled us into the war in Europe because of our opposition to the Japanese East Asian co-prosperity sphere. we're working down that checklist right now with China. We need to be careful.
So, Admiral, as we tie this back to our discussion we're having on NATO and on Turkey in particular, President Erdogan's spokesman has said that, quote, the Trump administration has established that it intends to use trade, tariffs, and sanctions to start a global trade war. How do you respond to that?
That wildly overstates the policy of the administration. And here I would direct the spokesman to read the national security strategy of the United States, which is a very coherent document, largely written under the aegis of our mutual friend, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster. And it lays out a broad sweeping vision of how the United States intends to create security. It does talk about using economic tools in the creation of security. All of this is a matter of degree. The administration, in my view, is not seeking a trade war, of all things. Nobody wins a trade war. But the administration is seeking to enhance the bargaining position of the United States in what it regards, and I think justifiably so in many cases, the unfair trade practices of other nations, notably China. So again, we should think of this not as a kind of an on and off switch of we don't do anything or we use our economic power to go to trade war, but it's a rheostat bill. You got to dial it in. And I think the administration needs to be careful it doesn't overweight that rheostatic dial. But I think this initial volley of tariffs, has got the Chinese attention and hopefully will lead us all back to the negotiating table. But I don't see and don't agree with the statement that the Trump administration is deliberately seeking a trade war. That wildly overstates the case.
And that's been the norm that we're hearing from other significant people, that is an overstatement, which I personally agree with. So, Admiral, as we come to the end of our program, I wanted to close with a question regarding the late Senator John McCain. At his passing, you were quoted as saying, if you think about John McCain as a compass, he could look east and west. He could look across the political spectrum, right and left, but he always steered true north. He steered the course he believed in. If we are to carry on this legacy of visionaries like Senator McCain, what do we have to do as a nation to ensure peace and security?
Yeah, I'll start with something very simple, Bill, and it's kind of what your audience is doing right now, which is to say we ought to listen to each other. And that means listening not only to those we agree with in our personal echo chambers on Facebook and Twitter and picking the news station that we know we're going to agree with either on the right or the left. We need to break out of that and listen to our opponents, listen to those with whom we have disagreements. Number two, we need to read more. We need to read fiction to understand the mores of the present. We need to read history and geography to understand how we've arrived at these situations that we are dealing with. We need to read magazines like The Economist, 175 years old, doesn't use bylines because they don't want ego involved in the product they put out there. And I will tell you, The Economist has a 90% accuracy overlap with the president's daily intelligence briefing. And I know that because for 4 years, I read the president's briefing, and I read The Economist cover to cover every week as the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. I throw that out as an example of an unbiased, clear-eyed journalistic effort. We need more reading collectively so we can cut through the clutter and the nonsense that we see pervaded as fact so often. And then third and finally, we need to invest in education, and that means educating our very youngest children in everything from how the internet works and how they can keep themselves safe in cyber secure environments to their understanding of our history. And from that, I think those three things together, Bill, we can continue to be a nation of values. of democracy, liberty, freedom of speech, freedom of education, gender equality, racial equality, hey, we execute them imperfectly, but they are the right values. We ought to treasure them, and three things we can do to tend that garden are listen better, read more, and educate in more efficient, sensible ways.
Admiral, it's been a fascinating and, as always, educational experience talking with you today. I can't thank you enough for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Bill, thanks a lot, and all the best to Ambassador Munner and the whole team at the East-West Institute. What a fine, fine institution. Proud of everything you're doing, and I'm proud to be part of this conversation today.
Admiral, thank you very much. For our listeners, remember to look for EWI podcasts on our website, SoundCloud, and iTunes under the name of East-West Institute, where you can listen, follow, and subscribe so you won't miss our conversations. Thank you all for listening.